Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Welcome to The Science of Success, the number one evidence-based growth podcast on the internet, bringing the world's top experts right to you. Introducing your hosts, Matt Bodner and Austin Fable.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another episode of The Science of Success, the number one evidence-based growth podcast on the internet with over 5 million downloads and listeners just like you in over 100 countries. I'm your co-host, Austin Fable, and today we've got an absolutely incredible guest, Clifford Hudson. We dig into his incredible journey throughout his life, from lessons he learned at a young age, why being a generalist is more powerful than you might think, and how you can find more opportunities in your life and chances to grow and learn than you ever thought possible. If you're looking to learn about leadership and growing not only a business but personally from a man with not only a great story but the results to back it up, then this episode is for you. And who are we kidding? Of course, that sounds like the kind of thing you want to learn. You are, after all, listening to The Science of Success. But before we dig in, are you enjoying the show and content we put out each week for you? If so, there are two incredibly easy yet tremendously impactful things you can do for Matt and I. And as longtime listeners know, we're always looking for little changes and big results. First, leave us a quick 5-star review on your podcast listening platform of choice. It helps other people like you find the show. So do them all a favor and leave us a quick 5-star review. Next, go to our homepage at www.successpodcast.com and sign up for our email list today. Our subscribers are the first to know about all the comings and goings of the show, but you will also have access to exclusive content you won't find anywhere else. Specifically, when you sign up, you're going to get our free course that we spent a ton of time on with an appropriate name, How to Make Time for What Matters Most in Your Life. Now, lastly, are you on the go? Maybe you're on a walk. Maybe you're enjoying some of this nice fall weather. Well, good for you. Sign up for our email list easily just by texting the word SMARTER, that's SMARTER, to the number 44222, and you'll be signed up today. On this episode, we interview an incredible guest, as I mentioned, Clifford Hudson. Clifford is an American business executive, best known for serving as chairman of the board and chief executive officer of Oklahoma City-based Sonic Corp. He is the author of the new book, Master of None, How a Jack of All Trades Can Still Reach the Top. He has served as a trustee of the Ford Foundation and is a past chairman of the board of the National Trust for Historic Preservation. We had a great conversation. We're talking about getting Cliff back on the show. He's got a number of topics he's discussed that we didn't get to today. We had a great conversation about many, many things, including personal stories from his life, the learnings he's taken from them, and a lot of the different things that he enacted at Sonic that really changed his view on the world. And with that, here's our interview with Clifford Hudson. All right, Cliff, welcome to the Science of Success.
Morning. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. How about yourself?
Doing fine. Doing fine. It's great to be with you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Absolutely. Well, it's great to have you on the show. You know, really appreciate the time. I know that it's kind of a hectic time of year, especially we were talking kind of before the show with you being on the road, traveling around to see family. So we really, really do appreciate the time. I want to start with, for listeners who may not be familiar with you and your story, you've got a fascinating journey, you know, ending in Sonic and really taking that company not only to the next level, but out of the stratosphere from where it was. But let's start, as a lot of great stories do, at the beginning. Just tell us about yourself and your journey.
Well, my entire family is from Dallas, Texas, originally, and all of us born there. My early years, elementary school years, were spent in Wichita Falls, Texas. My family then moved to Oklahoma City for my teen years, and something really hugely impactful in my life, which I referred to in the book, contributed to that move, and that is when I was finishing elementary school, my father's business partner, after some period of embezzlement, at least according to the story I was told years later, when the business slowed, the shortage of funds, the shortage of capital became painfully apparent. Business failed. My parents lost everything. And at that point, he took a sales position with another company, and we moved to Oklahoma City, which is the intersection of I-35 and I-40, great for a sales position. We were there, the family's there for the next 10 years. I then went east with my wife in our 20s to law school at Georgetown University. We were in the Baltimore, Washington area for 5 years and then moved back to Oklahoma City. And this kind of then set the stage for what ultimately became my Sonic career. Did go into a business law practice in Oklahoma City. But my timing was tough, and that was something we couldn't have foreseen. That was an oil bust in that region of the country that really unfolded in 1982. So I was involved in a business law practice from 82 to 84, but the clientele had changed so radically. I was pursuing, and it changed radically because the economy changed radically. I was pursuing Sonic as a client, as a potential client, and had a former neighbor that was an officer of the company. There was a new CEO, and he asked me if I wanted to meet the new CEO, and here I was, 29 years old. The idea of meeting the CEO of the company was fantastic, and in essence, they kind of turned the table on me and convinced me to come inside, and so at 29 years old, I found myself as a general counsel of what was a turnaround candidate. I didn't altogether appreciate that at 29, but I became general counsel of Sonic at 29, so that's kind of my path professionally that led me to join Sonic early in my career.
What an incredible compliment to you know, be calling on essentially what is a prospect and have them ask you to come in-house.
Well, you know, that's an interesting observation on your part because, in fact, I think what the then CEO, he was 36 years old, I said I was 29. I came to understand that his strategy was not one of let's get a young general counsel in here. His strategy was he secretly wanted to buy the company. He wanted a general counsel of the company who had sophisticated business law background so that, I think to be blunt, so that he wouldn't have to pay outside counsel to help him strategize about how to do that. That was 84 when I joined the company. And lo and behold, 2 years later, we did buy the company. The circuitous route. But 2 years later, we did buy the company.
I want to back up for a moment. And, you know, I'm always interested in, you mentioned kind of one of the big defining moments was your father's business sort of going under. What did you learn from that? Because I do always feel, you know, I'm a father now myself of a 2-year-old, but I always kind of think it changes the way you look at things. Like I now kind of look at my parents' life and I'm wondering what my kid will look at mine, and the things that you kind of learn and how important those lessons are. What lessons did you learn from experiencing that and seeing that? And was any of that facilitated maybe by a family member, or was it all just observation on your part?
Well, I handle those in kind of reverse order. I would have to say that the learning from that was more by observation. Frankly, I think it was a life experience that my family didn't talk about a whole lot about. The impact was negative and pretty obvious. We didn't spend a whole lot of time talking about it. The impact on me, I would say, was twofold at least. One was, as early in my life as possible, my adult life, once I had assets that were sufficient to do so, it was my objective, my wife and I were quite aligned on this, to pay off our house, retire the mortgage way in advance. I mean, you know, like most circumstances, I don't recall, but it's probably a 20 to 30 year mortgage. I think we bought that house in 89, and I'm sure we had it paid off by 93. So one was to not have creditor liens against the house, which most people have called a mortgage. So that was one takeaway, because I felt like it left my family in a more secure position if the house wasn't subject to creditors, regardless of what happened in my life otherwise. The second takeaway, I would say in my dad's business career, watching him and various aspects of real estate, construction, and otherwise, I think it's fair to say, I could use a bit of a euphemism, my dad had no concept of retained earnings. So it seemed that the quality of his business was reflected even after his bankruptcy. The quality of business was reflected in the size airplane he was buying and flying. The bigger the business, the more widespread. I mean, he had a new airplane, sold the old airplane, and just, you know, kept, I mean, it was a, he was, I think, aggressive with the real estate background. He was aggressive in the use of debt, you know, on every single project, et cetera. And I'm not really sure that any sense of building an enterprise that had sustainability was part of his scope. So that was the second thing that I learned in watching him, was work to build wealth and set it aside. And endow is not the right word, but set up children's college funds early on, let that build separately in a segregated manner. So these were lessons I learned not by seeing them done, but by seeing them not done, you know, and what the consequence was. I'd say those were probably two of the biggest takeaways from that experience.
Yeah, it's interesting that, you know, sometimes the most powerful lessons are the ones that you see from people that aren't necessarily acting out the lesson that you ultimately learn.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I think, first of all, negative events always have a bigger drive or motivator to learn a lesson, because everybody likes to avoid pain. And oftentimes in our lives, I think when we have success, we really don't learn lessons because we don't take time to reflect on it because we were successful. And secondly, we just like to assume it's because we're so brilliant and capable, you know, so
sure.
why question it? I do think the negative, now in that case, you could say I learned from my father, but believe me, the pain was quite personal. I think our family enjoyed the house. I know our family enjoyed the house we were living in, the neighborhood we were living in, the schools we were going to. And so it's quite disruptive to lose pretty much everything, you know, including the house. And then to relocate to a different circumstance where my parents didn't own a house for several more years. And when they did buy a house several years later, they only had it financed through seller financing. The owner took back the mortgage on the new house. So it was damaging to him and them and to our family, and a damage I wanted to avoid as I started my own family.
Well, it sounds like lessons that definitely hit home and that you've taken with you to make some decisions to make sure you don't fall into the same traps. But
absolutely. Absolutely.
I do want to segue a little bit here. So let's talk about the book, right? Master of None, How a Jack of All Trades Can Still Reach the Top. Now, I want to dig in, but just tell us a little bit about it.
Well, late in my career, I became CEO of the company in 1995. Late in my career, I think around 2016, 2017, I had come to the conclusion, for a variety of reasons, that many aspects of our company, its growth, stories that contributed to it, were interesting stories. And they were peculiar to the brand itself. And there may be variations on it in other settings, but I thought the stories alone were interesting stories. But the second thing was, I also felt like I had an interesting leadership story to tell. Not so much a here's how to manage a company, but rather here's how to to provide leadership in an organization that has application broadly, even if someone's not involved in a franchise organization, if they're not involved in a restaurant chain, there are lessons to take from those stories that I share in the book. And I felt like, before writing the book, I felt like that was the case. Good stories and very good leadership lessons in a setting in which they had those leadership methods had succeeded, you know, quite handsomely. So those were the motivations for writing the book. And then it took a while to put it together, in no small part because 2018 was quite interrupted with the Rourke group approaching the company and kind of rattling our cages about selling it, which they eventually did make their bids that the board simply couldn't ignore.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
So I'm curious too, like as someone just, I have this pipe dream of one day writing a book as well. You know, what was it like writing kind of like a memoir with a message? And I apologize, that's a little bit of a mischaracterization, but like, what was the process like? And through the process of putting it together, did you learn more? Did it reveal anything that you hadn't expected when you kind of set out? Because telling these stories of your past, but then weaving in sort of a leadership message, you're almost viewing it from like a retrospective lens, but it's kind of like reading old notes, right? Or like old journal entries. You can oftentimes learn something from reviewing them years later that wasn't immediately apparent at the time.
Yes, you're just right on there. There's nothing else, you know, when you spend 20 plus years running a public company and you have other things in your life in addition to that, life's full, you know, it's busy. And so the process of writing something like that does demand, by definition, demand reflection, recollection, you know, reconsideration. You know, did I make the right decision in those circumstances? So on and so forth. So, I mean, the answer is yes. Looking back in the process of writing the book, it was instructive to me about certain things that occurred along the way and the role these things played in my own development, my own understanding of our company, perspective about the company, but also leadership style, affirmation of styles and methods. So it was a big time of reflection and an interesting one. And I it was rich in its own way. One of the things that was quite pivotal in my development, as well as ultimately the company's development, I was made chief operating officer in 1993. I'd been with the company at that point 9 years, 8 years as general counsel, a year as CFO, and then was made chief operating officer in the summer of 1993, the end of our fiscal year. That coincided, so that put me in a position, obviously, of more control and oversight of the company, and I was the only person reporting to the CEO, and so all the other folks, marketing and finance and legal and real estate and franchising, all reported to me. So I was very much in charge of day-to-day operations in the company and strategic development. So one of the things that began at that time, and in a way it was kind of technical, but it was ultimately transformative, is we entered into what ended up being a 13-month process of renegotiation of our base license agreement with our operators. Now, what was the motivation there? Well, that was 93 going into 94. And within 2 or 3 years, we were going to have an enormous number of license agreements come to conclusion. And our franchisees, you know, a nightmare for them. Here they're needing to make long-term plans on debt, people, and real estate, and so on. And the last thing they wanted was to run up against a deadline on license agreements. Same thing is true for us. We were a public company. Last thing you wanted was to have 1,000 license agreements come to an end and not get renewed. I mean, it would be disastrous for the brand and for the company. So there we were, 3, maybe even 4 years in advance of that deadline, agreeing to sit down with our franchise leadership and renegotiate. So why was that transformative? Why it was transformative for me, because it forced a broader review process of what was in our license agreement and why, and how did that come about in the early 80s, and where versus what was in competitor, peer companies' license agreements. And when I compared those, I compared them for purposes of negotiation as part of the process. But it became very apparent that we were really lacking some of the authority, and you might say authority that led to strategic direction, but authority that was in some of our key competitors' license agreements. So in that 13-month process, we negotiated to modernize our license agreement. But we put all of those paths and powers and authorities in that new license agreement that our peer companies had. Over the next 5 years, that opened doors for us that we could not have opened otherwise. But perhaps first and more importantly was it educated me just coming into the COO role about what our alternative paths could be in advertising and marketing, in facilities, retrofit, trade dress of existing facilities, these types of things that you might know intuitively, but you could see were very much of a long-term path with most of our competitors. So that was a big change for me, but it also then set us up to have the authority as we sold, and we didn't make our operators adopt these things, but as we moved into new initiatives to grow the business, we had the backbone of knowing they were right because we'd proven them out to our operators, but we also had the big stick, you know, that we could hide of knowing we had the authority in the license agreement. So this was at the time you move through it, you move quickly, you implement some things that are new and powerful for growing sales and profit. The business moves quickly. But only when you go back and reflect later do you see and recall what a significant impact this thing had on my own mindset. Now, let me give you an example of where that became critical just as we were completing the process. And I refer to this in the book. My boss, the CEO, really did not participate in that process with us. He delegated to me almost completely. We had a team of people within the company that were managing the process. And by the time we were finished with it, 13 months later, I could see the dramatic importance of these new provisions and being able to manage and lead the company going forward, and not just the company, but the brand. So why was that a big deal? The franchisees, on the other hand, were getting a little tired of some of it and began to publicly, a little bit of an embarrassment, they were saying things publicly in the industry press about my boss. And he pulled some of us aside and said, haven't we gone on far enough? Can't we shut this thing down? What if we give them what they want in terms of trade area protection and we just take the money and forget all this other stuff? And it was so interesting because I had gone through such an education through the process that my reaction was, if you don't get these other powers and authorities, we will have cut ourselves off in terms of future path for growth. And it was interesting because at that moment and later, I came to understand that was an experience and an outlook that he and I had come not to share. It wasn't I think I came to see it, but it wasn't part of his outlook. And that was 94 when we completed and completed the deal. Just to give an idea of where his head was, really about 6 months later, he left the company anyway and took a new position. So it was interesting, the education for me and what that meant, and yet the lack of impression on him and how he was willing to kind of throw it out, you might say, you know, even as we were winding up the end of the process. So I forget, you know, you can virtually forget that because of the intensity of the next literally 20 years and 25 years. But as I went back writing the book, this was a fundamental period, fundamental piece and shift in our authority to manage the business, but also I think my understanding, appreciation of the levers that we would have to pull to move the brand forward for, you know, the next two decades.
You know, it's interesting. There's a lot of things we could unpack there, but it's like your boss at the time was really trying to avoid short-term pain at the expense of long-term control. But also, what a great project to be a part of, because, you know, even going back to the book, renegotiating this agreement required you to have at least some understanding of every single aspect of the business, and maybe not be a tremendous expert in everything, but really understand at a high level what it entailed, but not only that, but what the pieces meant for long-term strategic growth. Like, may not be a deep expert in advertising, but the power of advertising with one voice across the organization. So it almost seems like a crash course in becoming a generalist, because you have to understand these levers and which ones are important, which ones can be kind of not discarded, but maybe negotiated to really gain back control of the entire ship.
Well, I think that's an interesting perspective. And maybe in a way, it's a parallel path on the generalist and yet the quote expert. I'm going to use that term in the most general sense. Meaning, to that point, in terms of the generalist, I mean, I had been general counsel of the company for 8 years, CFO for 1 year, and then moving to COO. I had enormous on-the-job training of all kinds of things, not just how the company ran, but we had bought the company in 86 in a leveraged buyout. We didn't have the money to buy it, and so we leveraged the assets of the company to buy it. In 86, we bought it. In 88, we did a recapitalization. And so, and was I involved in all those? Absolutely front and center. In each of those cases, I learned a lot of things about the company, but I also learned more about corporate finance, dealing with investors and the likes. I then also oversaw the public offering of the company in 91. So I got all kinds of, you could say, expertise, but really what it was a lot of training about various aspects of the company, how we made money in company stores, how franchisees made more money, why we were predominantly franchised, these various license agreements over the years and what these meant. But then also dealing with the marketplace, private investors, private equity, and then the public marketplace, what those expectations were, corporate governance with a new board of directors and so on. So I really, in a corporate setting, I was the ultimate generalist. And yet at the same time, the parallel path would have been in that process of reviewing license agreements, et cetera. It really was to start getting down into more of a lever of a modern franchisor, more of the levers of a modern franchisor, and what these were that could help an executive, a lead executive, move a business forward. So in a way, that parallel path was getting more expertise in more areas, and I would say one that I grew in tremendously. One board member, you know, said I had up my bones, but in fact, I got more and more comfortable with it over time. No marketing background whatsoever in terms of education, and yet I got very comfortable with marketing more and more over time, and really enjoyed it quite a bit. So again, some development of expertise, you might say. But I was also dealing with a wider variety of things within the company. So a generalist all the while. So your point about the preparation to that period is well taken, demanding enjoyment of that generalist path, and yet periodically diving into specific areas and the need for specific involvement of a little bit more, quote, expertise, you might say.
So let's dig in. There's three basic rules in the book. So number one, don't plan, explore. Number two, don't specialize, generalize. And number three, don't keep your head down, turn it up toward opportunity. I want to double click really quick on number three, because I feel like there's this interesting idea, right? You know, the 10,000 hours to become an expert in something, like, do you really need to put your head down and focus that much time? I also think being a jack of all trades can sometimes be seen as like a negative, meaning you're not great at one thing. And all of these, I think, are kind of misconceptions. But what does number three mean? I mean, instead of keeping our head down, turning it up towards opportunity, what does that mean to you?
So I think, let me answer this in a couple of ways, directly on the concept itself, but also the reader and a person, you know, depending on what path they're on in life and what clicks for them and what they want to be doing. Mm-hmm. So one of your recent podcast was with the sleep deprivation fellow, and talking about, you know, since the 1940s, how developed society generally has moved towards less and less sleep. I think his comment was a reduction of 20 to even 25% average sleep hours since in the last 60 years. For a person to develop the expertise that your guest, if I recall his name was Matt Walker, I think, Dr. Walker, I assume, for him to develop that level of expertise, have the clinic that he had, the publications that he had, et cetera, he's got to dig in with a level of intensity and focus that exceeds, you know, what many of us are likely to do in our positions that aren't of that degree of specialty. Now, if a person's head works that way, and I do think, you know, clearly our brains from person to person, our brains are different. And some people enjoy things much more broadly and with greater variety, and some people enjoy things much more intensely and more narrow. If your brain works more that way, one, and two, you find topics for which you really do have a great passion, then I think the Malcolm Gladwell, you know, 10,000 hour things has more application to that type of person than I can easily say someone like myself, because that whole 10,000 hour thing just wouldn't have worked for me. And so a lot of it does depend on the individual, the skill sets, the way your brain works, you know, what you want to do with your life. But the fact is, in this context, speaking to a younger or mid-career person who doesn't find themselves on that kind of specialty path, let me just make the point this way. Someone could have insisted that I be on that specialty path, and I suppose early in my career I was. I mean, a more tedious corporate law practice. It didn't work for me, and it wasn't going to work. I needed to, the latter part of that, don't keep your head down, turn it up toward opportunity. I needed to have my head up and engage broadly, soak stuff in, engage in new things on a regular basis, even if they're in the same subject matter. And so in many ways, going from private practice to private law practice to in-house counsel, in some ways enabled me to do that, because it was essential that I learn about the business broadly instead of burrowing in on one document or one transaction, which a law practice, particularly as a younger attorney, demanded more of that more narrow and tedious focus. So my pitch to folks for whom this works, that's a funny caveat, because someone that's 30 years old and already finds themselves on a very narrow path that really clicks for them. They have passion for it. They like it. They can tell it works because they're happy doing it. You know, this comment has a little less application to them than the generalist, the person who does enjoy a variety of topics, trying to explore in life what, you know, what works for them. The opportunity is going to come along. Opportunities will come along. It's a mistake to believe you got to create all your own options, because options are presented to you. And if your head is down, if the old nose to the grindstone, if you're too narrowly focused, you're going to miss the opportunities that come along. And if you mistakenly believe you've got to create your own opportunities, you're going to miss the ones that are presented to you that you could seize, but not if your nose is to the grindstone and you don't see it coming. Let me give you an example of that I use in the book. There are a couple of different ways to go about this. The biggest one was when we bought the company. My boss wanted to buy the company, but there were 300 stockholders. There were a dozen stockholders that controlled the company, literally a dozen that had over 50% of the stock. So he really had a hard time breaking that circumstance, breaking that logjam. The founder of the brand, the founder of the company, owned 12% himself, and he wasn't interested in selling to anybody. What happened was another fella, he was a stockholder and a franchisee, but he was a former board member and former officer of the company and very aggressive individual. And I talk about him in the book. He approached my boss and I one day with his counsel and basically said, I'm going to buy the company and fire all of you. And I'm taking over, and this is what I'm going to do with the brand. Well, my boss wisely, he didn't do it all by himself, but he wisely used this as a way to alert the board that if they didn't want that to happen, they better do something. So what they did was they got their dozen stockholders together, 51%, and they all put it in the CEO. No, they all put it in the founder's hands, gave him an option to buy the stock to head off this fellow. Now, the founder, I think because he was on the board of directors, I don't know, but he had some fiduciary duty not to totally frustrate this effort to find that new value and a higher price for the stock that this other fellow was offering. So what he did was, what the founder did was, he took his option and he put it in management's hands, said, "You, I'm giving you this option. You have a year or whatever to close on it at fair market value." He, the founder, viewed that as end of the story. But my boss, the CEO, saw it as an extraordinary opportunity. All of it had been done simply to quiet things down and head off this Wile E. Coyote of a franchisee. But instead, my boss did work to raise the money, mostly debt, and that's how we bought the company. It was not an opportunity we created, but once it was there, you know, we seized it and ran with it. So I think there are other circumstances where people might not have been as aggressive about seizing the opportunity. There are smaller ones and bigger ones like that that I experienced repeatedly, you know, but regularly over my 23 years as CEO. But that is, to a large degree, whether it's a small opportunity or a larger, more meaningful opportunity, if your head is simply down all the time, you're going to miss things that come to you. And you've got to have a broader stroke, got to be listening and have your eyes open when those opportunities arrive.
That's such a great story. And it's interesting. It kind of reminds me of another guest we've had on the show, Dr. Richard Wiseman. But I'm curious, Cliff, do you think that you're a lucky person? Do you find yourself, would you characterize yourself as a lucky person?
I would characterize myself as a very lucky person. I had a lot of fortunate developments in my life.
It's interesting because, you know, don't keep your head down, turn it up towards opportunity. And hearing your story about the kind of crazy Wile E. Coyote of a franchisee and the owner, it reminds me of a study they did. And basically, the founding was that people that consider themselves to be lucky actually find more opportunity and really do, kind of to be a little cliche, create their own luck. And it's really not about some force in the universe. It's not about like karma. It's really about you having your head up and saying, you know, good things do happen to me, so I'm going to look for them. And then when you find these opportunities, you actually seize on them, as opposed to someone who may not consider themselves to be lucky, or in this case, kind of keeps their head down and tries to just get by, might just completely miss the opportunity and therefore, you know, become less, quote unquote, lucky.
Yes. Well, I can tell you, in the Great Recession, one evening at a franchise leadership retreat, several of us, I think there were at least three, maybe four franchise leaders there and officers at my home. It was a lake home. We were off at a retreat at the lake, so it was a more relaxed setting and one where I could deal with these guys late into the evening more comfortably. But we were sitting around the living room area late one evening at this retreat. And one of my fellow officers was really digging in with the chair of our franchise advisory council about information systems and his need to go through an update. The franchise leadership fellow kept saying he wanted to talk about challenges in newer markets. Now, mind you, we're coming out of the Great Recession. 9 and 10 had been very tough. This was actually 12. This was the spring of 2012. At one point, he remarked that, you know, for our newer markets, we refer to them as developing markets. He said that he thought franchise leadership would do almost anything to try to drive sales there. And I heard him say that, but I also heard this other officer come back to him and say, "Look, let's talk about your systems conversion." And it was so funny because here this franchise leader was opening a door to an opportunity that, because of the history and the culture of our system, I didn't think the door would be open. He was willing to open it. But my fellow officer, on the other hand, wanted to keep going back to a more tactical, narrow systems discussion. The reason it was so pivotal was because when that fellow, when the franchise leader said that about would he'd do anything in order to drive the performance in these new markets, I asked him something historical and kind of sacred. Are you saying to me that our franchise operators would be willing to break this half advertising local, half national if we could show them by moving more of the money, if not all the money, to national, that 100% of the system would come out ahead? He said, and he said to me, I am sure we could sell that. Well, that was total breakthrough thinking on his part, because this half of the money local, half national had just been sacred for a number of years. And franchisees really liked, you know, spending their money local because it made them pretty important players on a local basis. At any rate, this was a breakthrough piece. And it was interesting how it's something that could have been swept under the carpet that night, never heard, if we'd kept narrowing in on what about your systems conversion in your own stores. At any rate, so the point being really was almost immediately that opened up discussion about changing our advertising expenditures so that ultimately in negotiation with franchisees, we shifted so that 85%, roughly, 85% of all funds went into a national fund. That took us just 4 months to get consummated with the leadership amendments to all license agreements. When we did that and bought airtime for the following January 2013 and beyond, every single market in the system experienced a minimum of a 20% increase in gross rating points in their advertising. And some markets experienced as high as a 60% increase. So it's so odd that that single little statement by him, one of us hearing it and the other one not, one of us burrowing down, keeping their head down on an old topic, the other one listening to what the guy was saying, the head up, our business absolutely took off 2013, 14, 15, 16 because of that change and then some other marketing activities with it. So that was a very small, very slight example of burrowing in and keeping your head down versus head up, looking and listening for opportunity. Long story, but transformational for the business, but really made us a real national brand.
Yeah, that's an incredible story, and it illustrates the point so clearly and so well. And I think also, I think everyone listening to this interview right now is aware of the results. I mean, I have to imagine that must have led to opening up a lot of budget for the different things you could do, which like everyone and their mom knows the Sonic dudes, right? Sitting in the car, like rapping or rhyming or kind of bantering back and forth, which has, you know, since then even been expanded on to be more diverse and a little bit different, include different ethnicities and women. And really this whole idea of just kind of two, three people kicking it in a car at Sonic has just become like something you can mention really in any dining room in America, and people are going to know exactly what you're talking about.
Yes, yes, you're right. It had the effect in several ways. One is what you're describing in terms of just the reach of the advertising becoming, you know, very national. But the consequence of that as well was that our operators who had jumped out to some of these newer markets, which for us was particularly Northeast and Northwest and the West Coast, suddenly, instead of, you know, lackluster sales growth and below average unit volumes, suddenly their businesses just took off. And with that, their profits took off. And with that, their willingness to open new stores took off. The growth of the business through those years was huge and very positive. It also gave us badly needed money to reinvest in our stores, particularly, by the way, information systems and management systems within the store. And so through that decade, this really became an enormous investment in infrastructure to carry the business forward after that. So it was transforming for the business, more importantly for the brand, because the brand became, regardless of, when I say the business, I'm talking about corporation versus franchisees. When I say the brand, I just mean Sonic. And the brand became a national brand and a much stronger brand with that sustained national advertising.
So incredible. And Cliff, I definitely want to be respectful of your time. You've shared so many great lessons and good stories today. But one thing we always like to ask our guests before we let them go is, If you could give our audience one piece of homework, what would that be?
Wow, that's an interesting question. Well, I think that if one of the first things that comes to mind is in this category of turn your head up toward opportunity and exploration, I think that because the orientation is to double down, and we use that phrase often in all kinds of ways, rarely as it seen as being a negative, I think it could be interesting for the reader in terms of, or the listener rather, it could be interesting to turn their head up and give themselves an assignment. Look for a new opportunity. It's broadening. It's good for the brain development and good for their perspective, whether it's a new book or a new line of reading of books or musical instruments, art, engagement in community. I think this type of something that's a contrast but a complement to what they're otherwise doing in their workaday activities not only is good for brain development, I think it makes them a better employee, it makes them a better officer of the company, it makes them a better citizen of their community with that kind of broader enrichment, broader engagement. So in some ways that may be a person thinking about their career that may be counterintuitive, but that kind of refreshing energy and information for the brain, I think helps an individual in everything they do, not just in the new engagement. So the homework for someone may be find that new thing that does give your brain a shot of energy and then exercise it regularly, not to the exclusion of other responsibilities. But if you find something that works for you, feels good, and is energizing for you, then work it into your calendar and do it regularly because it'll make you a richer person overall, I think.
I love it. Such great homework advice and just advice in general. So, Cliff, where can people find you? If people want to learn a little bit more, they want to buy the book, they want to dig into all the great stories that you offer, where should they go?
Well, to learn more about the book, they can go to cliffordhudson.com, and that'll direct them in a variety of ways related to the book and its messages. Beyond that, as you might expect, the book can be bought at Amazon.com or Barnes & Noble or any number of other book purveyors across the country, including often, I think, in their independent bookstore, locally owned and operated. So either way, it's widely available. HarperCollins is a publisher, and hopefully they'll find it an enjoyable experience that'll not only be a diversion to their work in some ways, but ultimately a little bit of an augmenter to the career experiencing that the career experience that the average listener is experiencing.
I love it. And for everybody listening right now, go to www.successpodcast.com, and we'll include all of this in the show notes, including the links to Amazon, your website, socials, HarperCollins as well. Cliff, thank you so much for the time again. It's been great talking to you, great meeting you. We wish you much continued success and be safe while you're up in New York, all right?
Okay, Austin, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity as well, and best of luck to you.
Thank you so much for listening to The Science of Success. We created this show to help you, our listeners, master evidence-based growth. I love hearing from listeners. If you want to reach out, share your story, or just say hi, shoot me an email. My email is matt@successpodcast.com. That's M-A-T-T at successpodcast.com. I'd love to hear from you, and I read and respond to every single listener email. I'm going to give you three reasons why you should sign up for our email list today by going to successpodcast.com, signing up right on the homepage. There's some incredible stuff that's only available to those on the email list, so be sure to sign up, including an exclusive curated weekly email from us called Mindset Monday, which is short, simple, filled with articles, stories, things that we found interesting and fascinating in the world of evidence-based growth in the last week. Next, you're getting an exclusive chance to shape the show, including voting on guests, submitting your own personal questions that we'll ask guests on air, and much more. Lastly, you're going to get a free guide we created based on listener demand, our most popular guide, which is called How to Organize and Remember Everything. You can get it completely for free, along with another surprise bonus guide, by signing up and joining the email list today. Again, you can do that at successpodcast.com, sign up right at the homepage, or If you're on the go, just text the word SMARTER, S-M-A-R-T-E-R, to the number 44222. Remember, the greatest compliment you can give us is a referral to a friend, either live or online. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us an awesome review and subscribe on iTunes, because that helps boost the algorithm, that helps us move up the iTunes rankings, and helps more people discover the science of success. Don't forget, if you want to get all the incredible information we talk about in the show, links, transcripts, everything we discuss, and much more, be sure to check out our show notes. You can get those at successpodcast.com. Just hit the show notes button right at the top. Thanks again, and we'll see you on the next episode of The Science of Success.